hates women's desire and will as something which forces women into a bad situation in society and is exercised over them. I think that some of the what have come to be known as the pro-sex current in the U.S., Pat Califia, Gail Rubin, here in Sue Golding is with us today, and Chris Birchall in Canada, have called for a celebration of power between consenting equals in particular kinds of relationships, including those involving intense stimulation and high drama. Now, it's difficult to know exactly how to deal with the issue of power because of the problems around it and the way that power is often used against us. Yet I think that if sex isn't powerful, it's not worth having. If it isn't something that moves you and that does something for you, then why bother? You may as well have an ice cream cone, or if you're allergic to that, a carrot. Gary Kinsman, who is a Toronto gay activist, historian of sexuality and writer about sex, has talked about trying to think of power in terms of power with rather than power over. Because power with can encompass both the relationship where, you know, you're sort of clones and you do exactly the same thing and that's what you really want to do, to a relationship where through consent you give up to one another power, but it's through trust and through consent, which is of course a universe away from the negation. So we have to validate power through a notion of power with rather than power over and be clear about those kinds of distinctions all the way through. All right, I'm just about finished here. Which brings me to the next point. Okay, no it doesn't because I skipped a couple of pages. Forget the transition and let's get to this. I think we need to situate sexual representation, including sexually explicit representation, which deals with situations of arousal rather than just deconstruction or gender identity. We have to situate it in the context of the constant affirmation of women's right to safety, physical safety, and to our ability to take care of ourselves. And that includes turning violence back where it came from. That means that sexually explicit work coming from women has to be part of a larger context of representation in which women insist on their right to anger, their right to self-determination, and their right to fight back. And that can be done in all kinds of ways. It can be done by doing pieces which validate women's right to do that, which are separate from the sexually explicit, or it can be done by situating sexually explicit material within a narrative that shows that. But I think that we have to be clear that the patriarchal violence which comes our way is an issue in our lives. We can't pretend it doesn't exist. We have to address it in our work as cultural producers, as well as in our work as feminists, battered women's shelters, public education, all of those kinds of things. And so I think it's not a good idea not to talk about it. I think we need to talk about it. We need to talk about how we're going to deal with that and how we send messages to men that if they mess with us, they're really going to get it back. I mean, that's the kind of thing. And that raises the question of violence, which many feminists said we don't want, and has been part of some of the proposals of feminists for censorship. If we can't deal with violence in our own ways, we may find, or if we do deal with violence, we may find that our own images of violence, not just of sex, are censored because of the kinds of things that are involved around that. Okay, so we have to assert strength and our right to safety in the face of danger. Finally, I think we do need to deal with and we do need to speak to men. There's very little space to discuss masculine sexuality in this conference, and I'm not going to talk about it much. But I will say that I think that pornography, if it is at one level a discourse about women's sexual misery, is at the same level a discourse about men's sexual misery. I think that it creates a lot of anxiety amongst men. Some of you may be familiar with Nicole Hollander's book, I'm in Training to Be Tall and Blonde. Well, I think pornography is should be titled, I'm in Training to Be Big and Hard. Yeah, I didn't hear any of the men laugh at that joke. What pornography does is it takes images of, you know, superhuman phalluses and puts them in scenarios where only sort of steam engines could perform, which was, of course, the metaphor that Victorian pornography used to describe the penis, and sets up a set of performance anxieties and narrows all kinds of possibilities for sexual experience and exploration that works very, very poorly for men. And if some of you have had the enlightening experience of reading interviews with porn stars, which I have done, because I've had to look a lot at pornography and try to understand it, one hears amazing things like the men will say, only women are celebrated in pornography. The man is not celebrated. All they care about is dick. All they care about is hard dick. That's all that matters, and it's a very alienating experience to make straight porn. Well, I mean, that's really news to feminists, because they think that it doesn't celebrate the woman at all, but it celebrates masculine, or better still, male sexuality. I think porn doesn't celebrate anybody's sexuality, really. I'm not saying that there isn't something interesting or important that's going on there. So we have to, having said that then, how are men going to be able to see that there are differences between what's out there and who they can be if women don't begin to address them? How will men begin to feel that they have interests in the feminist exploration of sexuality, and that means the support of the feminist movement, unless they feel that there's something there for them in terms of the discussion, at the bare minimum, enough respect to say to them, listen, we don't like it this way, we like it that way. Please take that into account, and maybe you'll learn, and maybe you'll enjoy something as well. So I'm really glad that men are attending this conference. I think that's good. It doesn't substitute for all women gatherings. And I would suggest it doesn't substitute for all men gatherings, and that you guys who are here should get your shit together and talk to each other about your sexuality as well. But it is an important and essential part of the dialogue. So thank you very much.
Okay, we are going to take a 10-minute break. It seems that people really need it. So we'll come together.
Mom.
That might help to let people know that we've started. The presentation is by Sue Golding. And if you want to hear her, you are going to have to be quiet. Okay, and I am introducing her right now. Okay, she is a Toronto writer. She's a professor of theories of underdevelopment and political theory, and she is a radical pervert. Sue.
Great. I have a slideshow with me, which is about 15 minutes. What I'd like to do is talk for a few minutes beforehand and then go on with the slideshow. Before I begin, I would like to, first of all, thank the conference organizers. I think this is one hell of a good conference, and just wanted to thank them. Secondly, I'd like to thank the woman who spent hours looking at porn with me and took these pictures. It's a lot of porn in the show, incidentally. You will be hopefully glad to know. As importantly as this, I'd also like to thank the sisters and the brothers before me who were very brave, who are sex radicals, who are queers, who are perverts, who are whatever we are going to call them at this point, who stood in the face of unbelievable discrimination about talking about sex, and it's their work that I want to pay tribute to. I'm talking about people, again, like was mentioned before, Pat Califia, well, Esther Newton, Gail Rubin, Michel Foucault, who was a great pervert. He really was. Jeffrey Weeks, and a few other people that I should be mentioning but don't have on the tip of my tongue right now. So to them, a tribute and a thanks. Now, the story of sex. My presentation is entitled Aesthetics, Transgression, and the Politics of Sex. And it's entitled this because of a funny thing that happened to me on the way to orgasms. And I want to share that with you. On the one hand, we're only talking about sex. And on the other hand, we're talking about sex. And you should never forget that. And and I, unfortunately, have been reminded of this fact, first by innocence and naivete, and later because I was hard-headed and wanted to say what I wanted to say, and now simply because I have a good time doing it. But on the way to various O's, big O's, little O's, no O's, I was a feminist, and a lesbian feminist. I would identify as a lesbian feminist. I was always invited to conferences as a lesbian feminist, and always had lesbian feminist friends and so on. And then I went to London, England, and didn't think anything of it in terms of my sexuality. I went to the gay bookstore there, and I basically said, introduce me to every gay person you know because I'm new in town and I want to know these people and where the bars and so on. And there was a woman there with this wild hair and makeup and so on, and she said, well, why don't we meet tonight? So I thought, interesting. Okay, And so we went, myself and these new friends of mine, we went to a bar. And I said to her as we were talking, so what do you do for a living? I didn't know what else to say. You don't know where to begin. You just can't say, you want to have sex? You have to sort of break into it. And she turned to me and she said, oh, I'm a prostitute. I said, interesting. Okay, a prostitute, all right. So I said, that's interesting. I thought you were a lesbian. I never knew that there were prostitutes for lesbians. And she said, oh, no, not for, women. I'm a prostitute for men. Oh, I said, well, that makes sense. You're charging, and I guess, because you're charging, it's sex with men, but it doesn't really count because you're this lesbian. And she said, oh, no, the guys I like, I don't charge. Okay, so I said to her, oh, well, then you must be bisexual. Oh, no, I'm a lesbian. That's when I realized it was a very big world. And I did not know how big the world was until I met this woman. It turned out she was not just any old kind of prostitute, that is to say, what I considered normal sex. At this point, everything was like going out the window. She was a dominatrix. And she said to me, so you like leather? I wore a tribute. This is one of my sex toys I have around my neck. And I said, well, I suppose I like leather, and so she said, how about coming back to my place? I won't charge you. Gee, thanks. I didn't really know what to say, so of course I went. with this little voice behind me going, don't go. And she kept saying, are you nervous? And this voice kept saying, yes, and get out of here. And I kept saying, oh no, I'm not nervous at all. As long as those things that are on your walls are gonna stay on your walls, and things like whips and chains and handcuffs and whatever else. I never knew how many variations of canes there could be, for example. I didn't even think of a cane. I thought of a cane for walking purposes. So you can imagine my surprise. And actually, we ended up having what I guess you would call vanilla sex, or that's what it was called at the time, or Bambi sex. There's all these various kinds of sex. And all the time, it was because I kept explaining to her that I wasn't into that kind of stuff, the other kind of stuff. I was into Bambi sex and vanilla sex. And, and she said, oh, fine, that's fine. I'm into that too sometimes. So anyway, it was like Plato coming back from the cave. I decided to go, when I came back to Toronto, it was like, oh, guess what I did, and look what I've seen, and it's really great, and so on. And I was met with a stone wall and a lot of hostility. And it was an interesting experience, and I want to take you on a walk on the wild side. That's what this slide presentation is all about. Because my feeling is that there really is no such thing as sexuality. Sexuality is plural. I also think that there's no such thing as the thing called the male gaze, as opposed to this other thing called the female gaze. Wearing suits and ties and always being mistaken, nowadays I've femmed up the appearance, but I used to be mistaken for, you know, men all the time, and I liked that. I mean, I was glad when sales clerks actually said sir. And in my sex experiences now, as a, you know, whatever you call slut, a queer, whatever I am, I like when women say sir. I also like when they say madam, and I also like when they say Sue. Depends on the scene. For real. Now, all this to tell you that I think that the point about gender and sex that was made earlier on in the conference by several speakers, and notably Varda, the last speaker, that there has been a conflation between the two, and I'm here to talk about sex. And if you want to entertain questions around gender, that's also interesting. We can also talk about that. But the slide presentation, like I said, questions not what is sex, but how do we understand pleasure? Who's the we, this great we in the sky? And what do we what is to be made of all this? And so, so like I said, we're going to go on a little walk on the wild side. So could I have lights? Could you turn off those lights in the back over there? Part of enjoying pornographic images is doing it in the dark. So maybe if you, could those lights be turned off, or is that an impossibility? Oh, great, thanks. Okay. Now let's see here. In the contemporary debates erupting on the left today, and particularly those that are around sex and what is art and the aesthetic, indeed feminism itself, we've been introduced to three words, which I want to look at. These words have been neatly inserted into the political voice, and they've been elevated to the level of concept. They have a simple ring, and they are familiar to the ear. The first one, now that I can't see it all, the first is named deconstruction. The unpacking and repacking of our common sense sensibilities. I mean, what are those people doing in there? And are those people male or female? The second is discourse. That complex resonance of the socio-political voice. She's a pop singer, incidentally. And the third, the gaze that we've heard many times, G-A-Z-E, that haunting, ubiquitous, and unrelenting public eye. Oops, how'd that happen? This thing has a mind of its own. Their potency, the potency of those three concepts, deconstruction, discourse, gaze, the potency lies precisely in their double-edged complicity with both the familiar and the formal. The spaces of inquiry forced open are the so-called natural, the so-called self-evident, the everyday. They are the very gaze that the they are the very spaces that the feminist gaze made visible when the eye of the woman's movement pierced through the age-old assumptions and adopted the stance, the personal is political. Now, just a small comment about this piece. When it was unveiled at the turn of the century, men and women were reported to have fainted, women in particular. And there arose big debates in France as to what was it these women were doing. One had a ring in her left hand, as you can see, and the other one is touching the nipple of the other. And the other, there's a third person in the back sort of sewing or something. Like so the people were just shocked at this painting. Well, as a political theorist and a sexually active feminist, that's me as a sexually active feminist, that is to say, a sexually promiscuous and queer acting feminist, that's another version, or to put it another way, a gay activist, I have been attempting to take that profoundly feminist gaze and turn it in upon itself. That is, to use it to force open the seemingly natural, self-evident, everyday assumptions which some feminists have embraced around what is called pornography, as opposed to what others have called erotica. Pornography, erotica. And it dawned on me that the dimension of the fight or the debate which has emerged seems to have covered a terrain which has asked the wrong question. And in asking the wrong question has brought with it an entire array of assumptions that are at best, quote, incorrect, I use that very irreverently, and at worst, painfully destructive. The wrong question seems to me to have been what can be considered erotica as opposed to or different from pornography. Here we go again, erotica, pornography. That is to say, can one tell a book by its cover? What is it that should be considered acceptable, and perhaps therefore this thing called art, either as popular art, or perhaps even as a kind of record of the truth? This is supposedly a recorded truth event in the 20s of women hanging out together. In fact, it was considered very avant-garde for these women, the bohemian women of the time, as opposed to that which might be deemed obscene. This is Balthus. It's a very well-known painting in 1954. The guitar lesson is what it's called. As opposed to that which might be deemed obscene, as this might be deemed, and therefore pornographic, albeit art. What is the relationship between the two? And when is one the worse for it? Here we go again with art and pornography. Excuse me. And I discovered a funny thing on the way to this pro-sex, anti-porn, whatever else it's been called, kind of debate. That to pose the question in these terms meant to accept pre-established, already given ways of understanding what is art and whether or not this is art, whether or not this was sex, indeed, whether or not this was a female. That is, it meant to accept the very thing feminism had stridently pitted itself against earlier on, again and again and again. That is to say, all the various manifestations of essentialism, i.e. the acceptance of seemingly self-evident assumptions about the nature of reality, indeed, the very nature of people themselves. And so today, I pose to you a different question, a question which changes, I hope, the terrain of the debate. The question is simply this: how do we, as opposed to what is right or wrong, how do we actually speak sex? How do we actually speak sex? What is the relationship of what used to or what could be considered taboo and/or transgression? This could have been considered an obscene photo earlier on, and the history of that speaking of sex. In other words, how have we spoken sex, not simply in the sense of admitting to its existence, admitting to its practices, but in the very creation of those practices? Now, a word on this. This is Alice of the famed Alice in Wonderland. And as you may or may not know, Lewis Carroll was a pedophile who dedicated his work to Alice. And I wanted you to see Alice, because I think that we should uncover a lot, not uncover, but explore a lot of these sides that we don't usually talk about. In other words, what is it that we see when we look at that image? Is it merely a reflection of the so-called truth of pedophilia, or even of ourselves? What is it that we see up there on that screen? The response I'm going to give is not the answer of what it is we see when we see what we see. It's an answer which encompasses aesthetics, transgression, and the politics of sex. Here it is. We live sex, we speak it, we wear it, we construct it, we grovel at its feet. This is one of my favorite ones. Indeed, we might even be bored by sex, although not too many people talk about that. You name it. We do it in terms of a complex interplay between taboo, transgressions, and status quo definitions, an interplay which constantly changes, an interplay whose terrain is called culture. But not just some metaphoric name of culture, some pit which circumscribes an economic category like bourgeois culture or that of the working class, some absolute, unchanging, unitary thing out there, which we might engage in 9 to 5, but a culture here meaning at the very least a fluid expression of common sense and intellectual creativity, or in a word, aesthetics. To put it another way, aesthetics are the symbols, the living skin, as it were, of our eroticism, a skin which we inherit, a skin which we allow to mutate, to peel off, or to thicken, even by unnatural means, in this case. It is a continual process, and a historical one, to use an overused word, of making what is the private domain into what is to become a public domain, this relationship between public and private. Aesthetics in that context are the making of identities. But to abuse an already well-worn phrase of Marx, we make those identities not necessarily under the circumstances chosen by us. I don't care, I'd rather sink than call Brad for help. But rather, those that we inherit along with all the living nightmares, taboos, and ecstasies of our forebears. But the question then returns, what is it that we see up there on that screen? Is it bad? Is it obscene? Is it immoral? In trying to answer that question, I went back to take a look at the making of the modern, that is to say, visible homosexual. Now, I would like to just preface this remark by saying originally, and the slides that follow, originally this slide presentation was presented to a gay audience in a totally different arrangement of the slides to show the history of our sort of culture, that is a gay culture, that it's discontinuous culture. And in doing that, I realized that there was the sort of a subtext that needed to be explained further, and that's why I wanted to show you things, pictures like this one. What does it mean to talk about transgression beyond being queer in the what is now going to be the old sense of the word? There was this point, like I was trying to get at now, which seemed to surface again and again. In establishing new norms of sexualness, of erotic activity, the aesthetics that would catch both the changing common sense and intellectual creativity entailed this thing called a transgression, entailed a transgressing of the erotic body set by so-called normal society. This is a scene in a lesbian bar. It's a Brassai photo. And all the people in this picture, incidentally, in case you don't know, are women. And it's a butch femme scene in that context. And they are transgressing, both the ones that look like males and the ones that look like females. In transgressing those limits, new limits could be established. New dress codes, new sex codes, indeed new social codes. But how were they established, these transgressions? How did they become permanent? How did they become institutionalized, made to be common sense, or disregarded and consequently forgotten? Well, I propose to you that it's through a funny thing called indiscretion, that there's a move between transgression and indiscretion. And some of us are transgressors, and some of us are simply just indiscreet. But in all cases, that creates this kind of move. In this context of a, well, a young boy and a sadder situation, it brings an age and so on, we might call that image right now indiscreet. This would be transgressive. Indiscreet, transgressive. Indiscreet, transgressive. Indiscreet, transgressive. Indiscreet, transgressive. In other words, always this kind of indiscreet and transgressive, indiscreet, transgressive move that was creating new limits and new ways of viewing the body, what was a woman, what was a man, what was sex. And one of the emerging themes which seemed to become more apparent was the notion of this thing called, by the 1980s, the sexual fringe. This is my little picture of the sexual fringe here. The fringe of sexual practices emerging as public, unraveling the very unitary notions of what it meant to be heterosexual, homosexual, indeed romantically asexual, or rationally sexual. The continual making and breaking and reestablishing of new limits created new images of woman. And the subtext of this comment is clearly the role of technology in this, which I would like to get into more during the discussion period. In some ways, the last 150 years or so of industrialized society's posing of sexuality as a system of regulative constraints and the various forms of challenging those constraints through indiscretion or transgression or both, or even to use those constraints to build new images of what might be considered a woman, what might be considered dominant, submissive, feminine, sexist, all of the above, none of the above. Now, because of the advent of media, communications, not to mention various kinds of technology, from computers to electronic vibrators to the videotape used as a sex toy, has produced, to borrow Pat Califia's phrase, high-tech sex.